Right, well, let's turn next to post-implementation reviews, allow our discussion leaders to collect their thoughts for the report backs later this afternoon. Turn it over. Who's going to lead off on this? Michael, welcome.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody. I want to spend a little bit of time taking you through post-implementation reviews, both in terms of the process and the experience that we've had with conducting the segments review, and also talking about what we heard through the review of IFRS 8 and specifically about that standard. It'll be both myself and April Pittman who will be taking you through these slides. We've then got some questions for you at the end. April, you'll know as the person who's been leading the review of the segment standard. Also wanted to introduce to you Mariella Izzin as the Senior Technical Manager who will be conducting the IFRS 3 review on business combinations, which we're just about to start, or in just starting now. But April and I will be the ones taking you through these slides today. So, how are we going to split this up? I'll talk mainly about process. April will talk about the experience with the IFRS 8 review specifically. So the reviews that we conduct for standards, we do for all new IFRSs and major amendments. And as already been mentioned earlier today, this is conducted after 2 full years of implementation of a standard, which allowing for different financial year ends from companies around the world typically means after approximately 3 years of implementation. Now, the requirement to do the post-implementation reviews is set out in the due process handbook, and the original scope of these was that we should look at important or contentious issues identified during the development of the standard, and also look at the implementation problems encountered in practice and any unexpected costs associated with the implementation. Now, in conducting and developing the review of IFRS 8, we heard a number of people tell us that we should be going broader, so that is what we did with the IFRS 8 review, and this was also agreed with the trustees, such that this is now reflected in the revisions to the due process handbook. So our post-implementation reviews now have an extended scope that gathers evidence about all aspects of implementing the standard, and includes a public consultation aspect to the standard, and this involves identifying a number of key areas of the standard that we identify as being problematic, which we then ask for more information about through a public consultation and the use of a request for information document. Now, the PIR of IFRS 8 was the first one that we did, and we're expecting to publish our report on that later this month. At this stage, I want to hand over to April to tell us a bit about the IFRS 8 review itself.
Thanks, Michael. Just to remind you about the standard that was the subject of this post-implementation review, IFRS 8 requires operations to be reported through the eyes of management. The segments that are reported are those which are the segments that are used internally by the Chief Operating Decision Maker, the CODM, when he's allocating resources and assessing performance. The amounts disclosed for each segment are measured on the same basis as that used internally for each reported segment, and the reported line items are the line items that are regularly reviewed by the CODM. So when the ISB issued the standard, they thought that the management perspective would improve users' ability to predict future results and cash flows. They thought that it would help investors to better understand the business because they'd be able to see the business from the same perspective as management. We also thought that there'd be fewer single segment companies because they didn't think that anyone actually internally didn't disaggregate their own information. A big benefit would be that because it was internally available information, it would be easier to do and there'd be more information provided for interim announcements. And also, of course, it would give us convergence with the US. Now, at the time of consultation in 2006 on the proposals, there were some concerns. People were concerned that there'd be a lack of comparability between individual entities. There was also quite a lot of concern that there wouldn't be enough geographical information. IAS 14, which is the international standard, had both a requirement for disaggregation by product and disaggregation by geography. That dual requirement doesn't exist in IFRS 8. And there was also some concern that whenever an entity was reorganized, there would be a loss of trend information, which is something which investors find quite valuable.
So that set up the expectations for what we thought, or what the board thought, the effects of implementing IFRS 8 would be, and helped to shape the scope of our review. Now, the review that we conducted has been one that has been focused on a public one, much like the standard setting process itself. We took a phased approach in which the first phase was conducting some targeted outreach. First of all, using those expectations that April just took us through, but also speaking with a number of audit firms, regulators, national standard setters, users, to identify the key areas that we should be asking questions about in the public consultation phase. That public consultation phase then being the second phase of our post-implementation review. And that enabled broad consultation, so all interested parties able to participate. The request for information providing a framework on which to respond and to express some experience about the implementation of the standard. Now, that was the main part of gathering information from the public. We also did some outreach in which we attended or participated in a number of public forums, discussions, etc., many of which were hosted by national accounting standard setters. Now, in addition to that, that public outreach side of things, we also did a review of the available literature. This was focusing on academic and other reports that have been published. And so that provided another dimension to learning about the experience of applying the new standard. Now, this was conducted from sort of July of last year when we published a request for information through to the end of 2012. And then in 2013, the first quarter, taking that information and presenting that to the ISB. And in April 2013, the ISB assessed whether, on the basis of all of that collective information, both from the public outreach plus the academic and other literature review, it had sufficient information to be able to conclude on the experience of implementation with the standard, which it did do. And as a result of that, it's authorised the preparation of the report that we'll be publishing later this month.
Well saved. I should play cricket, perhaps. Messages received about segmentation. The first thing, of course, and the basis that we went into this review was that segmentation information is key, particularly to investors. And we think that the information that was provided to the post-implementation review confirmed many of the ISB's expectations that they'd had when we published the standard. The use of the management perspective did, for most respondents, make communication by management with their investors easier, and the incremental costs of implementation were low. In addition, of course, the standard achieved convergence with US requirements and at a very low cost. We also noted in the post-implementation review work that reported segments in some jurisdictions didn't change, and we think that's because those jurisdictions, people had already geared up their internal reporting to mimic the previous standard, and so there was no need to change those processes when IFRS 8 came in. The review of academic research confirmed that although the number of reported segments didn't change in many jurisdictions, when the number of segments did change, the number generally increased. And so the introduction of IFRS 8 overall has provided more detailed information about segments. Now, responses about the geographical information required by the standard varied. Some think that geographical segmentation should be a separate additional requirement, as it was in IAS 14. Others think that geographical disclosure may not be useful if it doesn't distinguish between regions in a way that's useful to investors. That is, in a way where the geographies are identified by economic similarities rather than just geographical proximity. The separate requirement in IFRS 8, which is an entity-wide requirement to report revenue by the geography of customers, that's considered to be very useful by many. So generally on the segmentation basis, preparers think that the management perspective works well. Auditors, accounting firms, standard setters, and regulators generally support the standard, but have made some suggestions to improve its application. Views on the management perspective that has been received from investors were mixed. Where you have the commentary, the segment analysis, and the investors' presentation all agreeing, that provides validation for all of them, and investors find that very useful. They place more reliance on that information, in particular because the segmentation note is audited. Some investors, however, are wary of the management perspective. They seem to mistrust management. Some of them think that the management perspective is used by some entities to hide loss-making sectors or, in fact, to hide what the genuine structure is. Certainly where there are differing segments in the different types of reports, management commentary or the financial statements, that can cause concern for both regulators and investors. And then there were a couple of other points, the identification of the chief operating decision maker, there were people who had concerns about how you do that in practice, and the application of the aggregation guidance. Some people think that that can be difficult. Now, looking at messages received about the line items reported in accordance with the standard are those line items which are used internally by management. And many investors and other respondents think that that is useful information in itself. It's worth knowing what management are monitoring and reviewing on a daily basis. Probably the most frequently reported comment that we had on the line items was the fact that there were a number of different reported operating results, entity by entity. One European study showed that there were 15 different definitions of operating result. EBITDA is a very common one. There are also operating results which have been adjusted for exceptional transactions, exceptional expenses. That was quite common. Some investors have said that they prefer to have the adjusting line items reported separately so that they could make their own adjustments to get the operating result. Now, some preparers also thought that the standard wasn't clear about what form the reconciliations should take, and investors sometimes found these reconciliations difficult to follow. Many investors said that they'd like to see the reconciliations prepared segment by segment so that they knew how the adjusting items affected each segment. Other respondents warned us against that because they felt that if adjusting items had to be allocated on a basis that wasn't systematic, that would decrease the quality of the information provided. Some key line items aren't reported. That was a concern raised in 2006. And academic research did show that the number of line items reported had decreased. Investors are interested in these individual line items, and they'd like to see them separately. They're interested in non-cash expenses because that's an adjusting item for them if they're forecasting cash flows, like depreciation and amortization. They also say that they're interested in investing activities, which they'd like to see separately, like CapEx, marketing, R&D, that sort of thing. And they're also interested in goodwill impairment, because that helps them understand if they have loss-making sectors to look out for or what the outcome of investment decisions have been. Having a quick look at the review of academic research, as we'd expect it when proposing the use of the management perspective, there were fewer single-segment entities reported in accordance with IS 14. The review of the academic research also supported the messages that we received in outreach and through public consultation. The academic research showed that there were a number of cases where there was no change in the reported segments, and where numbers did change, the number generally increased. The research showed that the number of reported line items had decreased, and there was mixed evidence about whether the geographical disclosures are adequate. Now, what did the ISB conclude about the standard when they heard this feedback, and what messages did we get? As Michael said, we took the analysis of all the sources of input into the post-implementation review to the ISB in April. And they agreed with, I think, the staff paper that the concerns didn't warrant a revision of the principles on which the standard is based, because the evidence provided to us during the post-implementation review didn't suggest that there were any significant failings in the standard. We did think, however, that there were some issues that could be included for improvement by the ISB. And those things were, there were a couple of requests for implementation guidance, the concept of the CODM. Some respondents think it's confusing and that it's outdated, the idea of having a CODM taking these decisions. They suggested that we could perhaps use something like key management personnel, which is an idea already in IFRS's. And also that the conceptual framework includes the idea of a governing board. Some preparers were uncertain about how the reconciliations could work, and investors say that they weren't always clear. So some people suggested we could just set out some implementation guidance showing a sort of pro forma of what an example would look like. And there were a few requests for improved disclosures. Where the segmentation basis varies year on year, people were concerned that they'd lost trend information, and investors said perhaps we could just require 3 years comparative information if that changed. Some guidance about what the operating result should be or what the operating cash flow should be, or alternatively the line items required to give that information would be useful. And there was also some discussion about aggregation. A number of investors think that there's either too much aggregation or inappropriate aggregation going on. So that were the specific messages that we had on the standard itself. And now Michael wants to talk about the process.
So the next steps in terms of IFRS 8 review is concerned, so say there'll be the feedback statement and report published later this month, and then following that we'll bring staff papers to the board to consider making amendments to IFRS 8 in response to those findings. This would really be part of our maintenance of IFRS's, and as April says, the findings of the standard really tell us that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the standard, so it's not a sort of start again occasion, but just a, you know, what improvements can be made. Now, with regards to what we've learned from the process itself, I think through the process we've learned that it's worked well. It's provided an opportunity for all who are interested to participate in the process, and that the public consultation aspect that and the public discussions by the board have been valued by stakeholders as being able to sort of provide a very transparent process. The that process we will now use for the IFRS 3 review. And so Mariella is just starting to conduct phase one, which is identifying, doing that targeted outreach to identify the main areas on which we should be basing our request information, and then we'll move into the broader public consultation aspect, as we did with IFRS 8. Sorry, I should just mention that with the bringing issues to the ISB for the consideration of whether we should be making amendments to IFRS 8, that is something that we will do also in consultation with FASB as well. Obviously, IFRS 8 is one of those converged standards, and certainly a priority that we've heard and that we want to maintain is the convergence of IFRS 8 with the US GAAP equivalent. Turning then to the questions that we wanted to ask you about today, and first of all, looking at how do post-implementation reviews help us meet our objectives. And what we wanted to do on this slide was to set out from our constitution, what are the objectives that we have in any case? We have the development of high quality standards, and we think that the post-implementation reviews help us review the effectiveness of the standard, and is very much consistent with that objective of developing high quality standards. Promoting the use of the standards, well, through identifying and remedying implementation issues, that can help those who use the standards and promote also or ease transition for those first-time adopters. Promoting vigorous application as we learn more about the difficult areas, so we can identify where improvements are needed to the standard or help others identify where implementation practices need to be addressed. And taking account of diverse entities and economic settings, as mentioned, this was a broad public consultation aspect to this, allowing all interested parties from whichever region to provide feedback on their experience that's fed into this report that we'll be publishing later this month. But at this stage, I wanted to open it up for questions, comments, whether it's about IFRS 8 specific review specifically, or in particular the process itself and your views, perspectives on the ability for this process to help us achieve our objectives.
Liz.
Thank you, Paul, and thank you very much for that presentation. I'm just questioning, how do you identify which standards are you going to be subject to review? Because I'm just somewhat concerned in relation to business combinations, IFRS 3. Looking at the UK market in particular, it's been a very calm market for the last few years. There have been very few mergers and acquisitions because of the financial crisis. Indeed, we did a rights issue fees inquiry and we sought to find out whether or not those recommendations had been adopted, and it took about 5 minutes because there's been one rights issue in about 18 months. So, that's my question. Thank you.
Okay. Good question. And what our intention is with each of these reviews, that yes, we were required after approximately 3 years to start the review. We would then start this phase one, looking at doing some targeted outreach, finding out about where the problem areas have been. Now, if we were to find that there really hasn't been enough experience yet of applying a standard, then at that stage we would assess what we have learnt from that targeted outreach. We would consult with the trustees and then discuss with them whether, in fact, we should defer the remainder of the post-implementation review until a later date, till there has been additional experience that would make it then worthwhile of proceeding at that stage.
Karen.
Thanks, Paul. A question with respect to BlackBerry's too close. Effects analysis. For those standards where you did an effects analysis at the outset, would part of this process be a look back and validating that effects analysis? I'm thinking particularly of revenue recognition.
Yes, it absolutely will be. And our normal process will be to start with the effects analysis as being one of the primary sources of identifying areas that we should be looking at. With the case of IFRS 8, we didn't have one. So effectively, April reconstructed what would have been the effects analysis based on looking at board papers, the basis for conclusions, other publications published at around the time, not necessarily by us, but by others. So we were April was reconstructing that, but that's very much the starting point that we would then build on.
Thomas.
Thank you. Just a remark concerning the IFRS 8 post-implementation review. We had some discussions also with analysts about IFRS 8, and just to echo some of the concerns you mentioned during your discussions you had probably with investors, the basic line what we heard was that IFRS has led to less segment reporting, less valuable segment reporting, especially because it seems to be that management has too much leeway, too much discretion to get around, let's say, more precise information. Just to echo that one, and to probably you should have a closer look at the conditions you put in when you do have small amendments to IFRS 8. And the other things, I mean, what you mentioned, reconciliations, EBITDA, exceptional expenses, those were the issues where they had concerns. And probably you have a closer look at that one again.
Thomas, can I just clarify with you, when you say less segment reporting, are you talking about the number of lines reported per segment?
Well, there were actually different aspects in this. One was that basically at the end there was only one segment. So there was too much leeway, too much discretion for the management to define the segment as such. And who were the chief operating management who stood taking the decisions. It seems to be that they were basically actually against IFRS 8 as such and wanted to move back to the old times.
Certainly, identification of the chief operating decision maker, which then leads on to identification of the segments, is an area that has come through as being an area for greater clarification. In terms of the number of segments, though, or the number of single segment companies, the academic research suggested actually there were fewer of those. But that doesn't mean that there aren't more than there should be, perhaps, given the difficulties with both identifying the CODM, but also the aggregation criteria as well, which would obviously lead to the number of segments ultimately reported. And that's certainly an area that we'll be looking at again.
Jerry?
Thank you, Paul, and thank you all for an excellent presentation. From our earliest discussions of the PIR process, the people that I work with in the North American insurance industry have strongly supported it. So I think this has been an excellent example of why we need the process. I wanted to just come back to a point that got made this morning that I had originally been asked to make by my constituents related to the PIR process. And that, in some ways, that was raised indirectly this morning because of the statement about the revenue recognition discussion group or discussion process as this complex project goes into actually into implementation. The thought that occurred to me then, and as I've thought about it, really seems to fit because it has both impact relative to implementation as well as to standard design, is whether we should be calling these things post-implementation reviews or post-adoption reviews. And with the idea that for certain very complex standards, this was really the proposal, and the idea was for these complex proposals that rather than waiting for 2 years or the 3 years or the period of time to go through, some of them are sufficiently complex that issues of implementation can arise. This was particularly raised by the Canadian life industry who've just gone through implementation on certain financial instrument applications, and as the word they keep using is the devil's in the details. And I think that was partly this idea. The RevRec discussion group was to be able to address those. Of course, they can, those kinds of discussions, while I think absolutely appropriately, should not result in the issuance of documents so people then... We're not striving here toward a rules-based approach. We recognize the importance of the principles basis, but so not to have this issuance of documentation, which then starts to look like specific application guidance, but yet can actually provide assistance in the implementation of a new standard. So the question or the request would be maybe as part of the PIR process maybe change the focus to be post-adoption reviews as opposed to just post-implementation, and then for highly complex standards to be able to have a basis for these discussion groups that have been described that could be a feeder into the process of the more formal, complex post-implementation review that you would do in the normal way when the time became right. Being sensitive to Ian's point that you need to have a certain amount of experience before post-implementation reviews appropriately, but you do learn something as people go through the implementation process as well.
Roxana?
Thank you. 2 points. One on IFRS 8. I would just like to echo that securities regulators in Europe had a lot of concerns about the concept of CODM. It poses a lot of difficulties in practice in the enforcement process. And second point, I can understand the fact that maybe it's too early to do a post-implementation review on IFRS 3 because there has not been a lot of business combination. We have noticed actually a lot of issues with IFRS 5, and since you mentioned that you are reviewing the standards which have been converted to US GAAP, maybe it's an area which deserves attention in the near future.
I'm not sure. Is it Begonia?
Yes, a couple of questions. The first is about the public consultation that has been made in order to get the information. And perhaps you have already mentioned that, but I did not understand or I did not listen about it. Where did you do this public consultation? Who was consulted in this analysis? And the second is about the literature review. If you are planning to prepare a document about this post-implementation review, it would be good to know the reference of the academic literature that has been taken into account.
We did the consultation really in two stages. The initial stage that we did, which was the planning stage, we consulted widely with members of IFAS, with investors, with the Big Four and accounting firms generally. And that highlighted the sort of issues that we thought that when we did the formal consultation in the request for information, we should actually be probing more closely into. We then went on in about April, when the process had been approved, to consult with people. We had 36 outreach events, which were generally organized through local standard setters or through local regulators or investor groups or academics. And that covered a sort of a wide range of participants and a fairly wide range of geographies. We also used a lot of different methods for talking to people. So we did a lot of our discussion forums by video conferencing, particularly in Asia and the Far East. We did, I think, one or two webcasts. We also had some individual meetings with people because there were some concerns, particularly amongst preparers, that they really didn't want to come out after the standard had been implemented for 3 years and say, well, actually, we've been reporting all these years, but we aren't sure we've got this right or that right. So we did give people the option of being confidential when they spoke to us about things. So I think we had quite a broad range, and we also relied on the local standard setters as well and local regulators to collate information from their own constituents, particularly those constituents who wanted anonymity. We kept, obviously, all the comment letters on our website. A number of the regional discussion forums that we had, there were minutes published for that. One or two of them were broadcast. I think, for example, EFREG published minutes on almost all of their discussion forums. So it was quite broad. And as Michael said, the nature of the questions were also very open. We didn't want to restrict people in the areas of the standard that they covered.
On the question about the academic references, we included those in the public board papers that were discussed by the board in January of this year, but we'll also, I think, make reference to them in the report, just sort of, you know, so that it's easy to access. But yes, all of that data is available.
There we go. Could you use your microphone, please, Michael?
Of course, there is need to provide more guidance. And in the reality is, you know, as a board member, observe the EFREG meetings. And I noticed, you know, nearly, how to say, it's hard to say whether most of, maybe one-third at least, of the issues in front of EFREG is related to the standards just issued, or within 3 years, let's assume. And some of them are minor errors, and some of them people will say that we need more guidance or clarifications, and some of them may relate to the areas which board intentionally to miss it when develop a principle-based guide standards. And actually, you know, as I understand, our IFIC and the board quite often face such kind of dilemma. You know, on the one hand, people ask more guidance or more clarification on others. But on the other hand, whether we need to make standards stable for a period, otherwise there will be no time of calm. I'm not sure what's your views or other board members, SEC members' view. I think your suggestion is right after implementation, we should start provide guidance. Am I right?
Very briefly, please, Jerry.
First, the suggestion wasn't to actually make amendments to the standards so quickly. It was more in the spirit of the discussion group that is being suggested on revenue recognition, and also not seeking written guidance. In other words, the purpose here was not to develop a body of literature which would turn this thing into a rules-based process. It was intended to be more the kind of a discussion which I was very interested to learn about that's being contemplated for RevRec.
Okay. April, do you want to take us through the last little bit?
The second area that we thought you might be interested in is how we should coordinate post-implementation reviews where the subject of the review is a converged standard. Now, when we first started this process, a number of people asked us, why aren't we doing this review jointly with the FASB, because they are converged standards. That's not really possible for a number of reasons. If you look at what the objectives are in our methodology, the objective under ISB is to assess the effect of the application of the standard. It's a very broad objective following the trustees' review last year of the requirements. The FASB objective is more restricted. It looks at the effectiveness of the standard-setting process and whether the standard achieved its purpose. So it's not quite as open as ours are. The responsibility for the post-implementation review under IFRS rests with the ISB. The trustees thought that this was part of the standard-setting process and should remain with the ISB. Under FASB, it's actually performed by the trustees' staff and by third parties. The methodology is very different. The third parties select a population. It's principally done by survey, very, very detailed survey. Our methodology is much, much more open. The input to the review, as we've said, is carried out in the public domain, subject to public scrutiny. That provides a lot of detail because you can see the detailed comments of the comment letter process. You can see the minutes of the outreach when that's recorded. So there's a lot of really sort of gritty detail in there. Whereas for the FASB, their policy is that all the data is collected in absolute confidence. Who took part and what they said is not known even to members of the FASB. So it is an entirely confidential thing. And as it happens in the case of IFRS 8, the period that was covered by the review was quite different. Ours was 3 years after global implementation, effectively. The FASB was 15 years. So that's quite a significant time span. Just looking at whether our findings would be the same, the assessment process of the need for any sort of improvement to an IFRS, if it has been converged, needs to take in quite a lot more factors than you would in our normal agenda sort of considerations. So first question is whether we're assessing, what we're assessing is different. Did we and the FAF identify the same issues? Now, our constituents may have different starting points. The standard that the US standard replaced might be quite different from the standard that the IFRS replaced, so that the effect of that change would be quite different. So that will make it difficult that constituents are gauging the implementation differently. As I said, our process generally is likely to provide much greater detail about the issues that have been identified. And then when that identification takes place, and we have been talking to the FAF staff about the IFRS process, and they have been monitoring the board papers that we've presented, even when they take into account the greater number of issues or the different issues that we've found, there's also the question of, are we going to ascribe the same priorities to the addition, to the issues that we've identified? So how do our agenda setting criteria compare? And also, of course, what's the availability of our resources? And then finally, will we tackle the issues in the same way? We need to consider what form any amendments that either board would take would take. And a proposal for a major revision of one of our standards would be considered in line with our triennial agenda consultation process. Focused amendments could be different. We probably have a wider range of tools because we've got the interpretation, the annual improvement process. We already have a history of narrow focus amendments. And the ISB also have the ability to ask the Interpretations Committee to assist with that. And then the final question would be, what form of action or additional guidance would most help our respective constituents? In general, our constituents tend to prefer clarification of principles. Perhaps the FASB's constituents tend to prefer more detailed guidance, guidance with perhaps bright lines or industry-specific rules. So where we've got to at the moment on this commitment to convergence. The FASB have done a top-level response to the FAFS report. They haven't yet done their detailed response. But they have said that they'll discuss the report's finding in detail with the team and the ISB staff to coordinate an evaluation of the issues in an attempt to maintain a converged approach. And they'll weigh the desire to remain converged with their other priorities and the demands on their resources. And we have actually had several very useful meetings with the ISB staff, the FASB staff. As I've said, they've been through our board papers, and to the extent we've had more detail, they have added that to their evaluation. We don't yet know what that report will say, but it does look to be very similar to ours. This was brought to the April 2013 meeting of the ISB, and the ISB concluded that the development of any proposed amendment to an IFRS that is converged with the equivalent guidance in US GAAP proposed as the result of a post-implementation review should include active liaison with the FASB, and we are in that process for IFRS 8. So I don't know if you have any questions or comments on the intricacies of keeping converged standards converged.
Any takers? I guess listening to it, April, I didn't find myself persuaded by your arguments. It sounded more like a justification or a rationalization. As came up earlier in the day, you know, we struggle hard to reach a converged standard, and that's really just the starting point. And I thought quite a few of your comments, I think, are absolutely right in terms of what each board might decide in light of the assessments done. But personally, I still find it a little troubling that similar processes, and I don't think the objectives are as far apart as, in fact, I would have argued the opposite position. I read some of the foundation material that I've seen in the U.S. as being potentially broader than, but I don't, at the end of the day, I think you're splitting hairs. So I guess my personal view would be absolutely agree that you need to liaise when you've decided next steps. But if your information database and assessment are out of line, it's going to be cold comfort to people, I think, saying, well, you know, we potentially have one board going off one way and the other side.
How do you propose we fix it, Paul?
Well, it's easy to criticize, and I understand it's something that can't be done unilaterally, but looking ahead more to something like an IFRS 3 and perhaps next generation standards, I think some of the arguments for the arrangements that we're using at the moment aren't as compelling, but that's purely a quick personal reaction.
Just say it is difficult because, like it or not, the FAF actually went ahead and they've completed their BizCom review. So they've started, initiated, and completed, and they decided to do that by themselves. So we're a little bit of that is out of our hands. I think we would welcome them being involved in our process, but it's very hard, much harder for us to be involved in their process because it is a closed process and they focus only on US constituents. I think the one thing we learnt out of, particularly out of the IFRS 8 review, was that we actually stayed away from the US a little bit, relied on a CFA survey that had been conducted relatively recently, but we actually didn't go in and do much US outreach at all, if any, because we knew the FASB, or the FAF, was actually doing their review. I think we've made a commitment through our due process oversight committee that we would remedy that for the next reviews. Because there are so many investors using IFRSs in the US, we should go and speak to them in the US as well. So because we don't know what's going on inside the FAF review and we can't get access to it, we actually have to go in and do some of that ourselves. So unfortunately, there's a crossover, but it's been unavoidable so far. I think the best we can do is to think about longer-term revenue. We've got till 2021 to plan for that. So, and maybe that's the sort of thing where we can, with a real joint one, do it. 2019, I should say.
Francois.
Thank you. Well, I mean, considering that the ISB is liaising with bodies which are completely independent and they can make decisions the way they wish. Considering the fact that from the US perspective, in fact, it's been taken, this post-implementation reviews have been taken from a supervisory role perspective, I think if in the end, I mean, if the best efforts are done to have as much coordination as possible, if in the end the two boards agree to consider what amendments eventually have to be made to standards, if that effort is done together, I think we end up in the in a reasonable world. And so I personally was positively impressed by all the efforts that were being made to get to that point. And maybe this group could have, you know, a role in liaising with the foundation and maybe sharing some comments and making recommendations so that convergence is best served.
Thank you, Francois. Leo.
Thank you, Paul. My comment was actually, I think, following up on Francois's point. I think you said, Michael and April, that you had to sort of reconstruct the effect analysis, or to reconstruct the purpose of the of what the sense is trying to achieve. I think going forward, that will probably be less of a problem because that has been identified together between the two boards, so that it's probably easier to find common ground in what the actual criteria is that you're looking for. So I'm like Francois, I'm probably more optimistic on that. So I think it's both the start and the end, that for the next batch of post-implementation reviews are going to hopefully going to be the same, which gives you a higher chance of coming up with the same conclusion.
Jeff.
Thank you, Paul. Alan, just a question. You said you didn't have access to the FAF information. My question is, did you ask them for the information? And if so, what was their justification for not providing it? Thank you.
Yes, we did ask them for information. And because it is a confidential process, it does put the staff, I think, frankly, in a rather embarrassing position. So, for example, when the FASB discussed the staff's paper on their findings and what their proposals were, although the discussions were held in public, the papers weren't actually published. And we were in the same position as the other observers in that they were discussing paragraph 63 or appendix 2, and we did not know what the contents of that were. Now, subsequent to that meeting, we were given access to their board paper, which laid out in summary what their findings are. But we have asked, obviously, throughout the process, and I believe we did, at the beginning of this process, have to agree to a confidentiality agreement with them. So, I mean, it is a very significant factor of the FASB's operations that these things are confidential and that the papers aren't necessarily in the public domain. But, yeah, we certainly did ask.
All right. Well, seeing no other cards up, assuming that has covered off what you had want to bring to our attention. On that last point, it's something that we as a council had identified as a particular concern to us at an earlier stage, and I think we'll simply refer it back to our agenda committee with the view that on an ongoing basis we might want to come back to the aspect of how the coordination is playing out. And I take the point made by Francois and Leo that the extent that you can, you're trying to liaise. And it certainly, my comments weren't meant to be one-sided in saying that the problem, if there is one, is with the IASB. It's just there's so much of a shared interest here. I think the council may want to continue just to prod both sides indirectly. I think that, you know, if we can get the message back to the U.S. that this is of concern to us, so much the better. Is that fair comment? Are we ready to move on?